You're listening to episode 97 of Bionic Planet. This episode is entitled The Mosaic, The Minefield, and A Manifesto, for reasons that will become clear if you listen all the way to the end. It's part of a new vertical that I'm calling the Tribes of the Climate Realm, because out of 7 billion people on this planet, only a few thousand of us have been working to meet the climate challenge for any discernible length of time, some of us since the First World Climate Conference in 1979. To outsiders, we're seen as an alliance of like minds, but once you cross into the climate realm, you'll see we're a disunited hodgepodge of tribes who occasionally unite against a common enemy, climate change, but who are divided by ideological and sectarian differences that sometimes erupt into something akin to civil war. Tragically, as often happens in these situations, the most combative, belligerent, and least civilized tribes are usually the most colorful, despite having the least to offer. A lot of these colorful characters are just oddballs, outliers, and opportunists, but they're often the people who outsiders are most familiar with. That's led to a dangerous disconnect between the real debates taking place inside the climate realm and the public discourse unfolding outside of it. I initially started to call this vertical Unmasking the Anti-Red Crusade, because there is a very high-profile anti-red crusade, but I felt that frame was too narrow and dismissive of legitimate challenges, philosophical disputes, and areas where reasonable people can disagree. We need to elevate the public discourse, but that doesn't mean replacing anti-market propaganda with pro-market propaganda, although it does mean purging the bunk that's out there already. Back in 2021, I warned that if we didn't do something to stifle the waves of bunk flooding into public discourse, then the false narrative would become something like Paul Krugman's zombie ideas, marching on despite contrary evidence. That, tragically, is what happened. And you can learn more in the show notes at bionic-planet.com. That's bionic-planet.com. Look for episode 97.
Man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization.
There's a group of us now who are proposing that the Earth has actually entered a new epoch, and that is the Anthropocene.
We know that the enemy is carbon, and we know its ugly face. We should put a big fat price on it, and of course, add to that, drop the subsidies.
Earth, we broke it, we own it, and nothing is as it was. Not the trees, not the seas, not the forests, farms, or fields, and not the global economy that depends on all of these. But we can restore it, make it better, greener, more resilient, more sustainable. But how? Technology? Geoengineering? Are we doomed to live on a bionic planet, or is nature herself the answer? That's the question we address in every episode of Bionic Planet, a podcast of the Anthropocene, the new epoch defined by man's impact on Earth. And today we address it with a sneak peek into the episodes that will be dropping under this new vertical. We'll start with an email I received last week from a member of a tribe that didn't arrive in the climate realm until 2020. He's a crypto dude who shall remain nameless for now because he's done no damage yet. Plus, there are dozens of him who have done damage, as well as some who've done some good, and I'll be naming them in due time. This particular crypto dude appears to have developed an instantaneous and deep devotion to the climate cause in 2022, around the time anyone with a nose could smell money in it. Kudos to him for his conversion. And no judgment on him for trying to make a living delivering solutions to the climate challenge. I spent the last 20 years of my life spreading awareness of the mechanisms that would allow people to do just that. But I smelled more than money in his mail. I smelled a rat. Because his mail was all about how he was going to quote-unquote fix the voluntary carbon market, despite the fact that he, like many of the people you'll be meeting in this vertical, has no discernible expertise in carbon finance or land use change. He's also fixing something that is not broken, and his so-called fix illustrates why I say that. His fix is to crush rocks and spread them on farms where they'll absorb carbon and improve soil. It's called enhanced weathering, and it's not a bad idea. In fact, it's a pretty good one. I first wrote about enhanced weathering in 2008, but even I was late to the game. The game starts in the 1840s, when French geochemist Jacques-Joseph Abelman realized that carbon moves through rocks just as it does through trees, in a cycle of capture and release. In rocks, it happens over millions of years, while in trees, it happens over decades. In forests, it happens over thousands of years. But don't tell the Crusaders that, they'll burn you at the stake. The whole debate over permanence in land systems is one of those areas where the disconnect is especially egregious. Abelman published his theories about 50 years before Svante Arrhenius discovered the greenhouse effect, so the insight wasn't seen as a solution because no one knew there was a problem. But by the 1970s, scientists started wondering if we could speed the removal of CO2 by grinding certain rocks into powder and spreading the dust on roadsides or on farms. Everyone agreed we could do it, but there were so many uncertainties that it wasn't until 2022 that one of the newer carbon standards, Puro.Earth, published a methodology for using enhanced weathering in carbon markets. But a funny thing has happened since. The more established carbon standards have yet to sign off on any such methodology. They've been bogged down in scientific review for years, mostly because experts disagree over how this stuff impacts soil. This raises some intriguing questions. Is Puro Earth wrong and the others right? Or are they just taking different approaches? Why are there multiple carbon standards generating different methodologies? How much uncertainty is too much, and who decides? I'll be chewing over these questions as we meet the tribes of the climate realm, but for now I just want to point out that the standard-setting bodies already have the best minds on the planet working on this particular solution, because the voluntary carbon market isn't broken, at least not when compared against viable alternatives instead of imagined states of perfection. One thing that will become abundantly clear in the next few weeks is that the voluntary carbon market exists to achieve two things. One, to test and improve promising but immature climate solutions, and two, to entice companies into funding emission reductions beyond what the law requires or what they can achieve internally. In the next few weeks, we'll look at the genesis of the Verified Carbon Standard, or VCS, which began taking shape in 2005 and had, by 2022, become something that its creators never intended it to become, namely one of the few successes in an otherwise dismal response to the climate challenge.
Let's not forget that we're here because we failed.
Mark Kenber is an environmental economist who's been working the climate puzzle for decades. He helped Ecuador leverage environmental markets to reduce industrial pollution in the 1990s, and he initiated the VCS in 2005. I spoke to him in early 2022, when the voluntary carbon market was being hailed for succeeding where other efforts had failed, which is true, and for pioneering new methods that will help us drive emissions even deeper in the future, which is also true. You'd expect Mark to be doing a victory lap, but he wasn't.
We've been negotiating international climate change since 1987, 1988. We had a framework convention in 1992 where, remember, rich countries promised to stabilize their emissions by year 2000 and so on and so forth. And we shouldn't be relying on voluntary action now. But the fact that we are, we still need things like VCS, like VERA, like the work that's continuing, because that's got to plug a gap that we collectively have failed to fill.
In the coming weeks, as we examine the genesis of the VCS and gold standard, you'll come to understand the processes that are moving it forward and how these processes help us plug the gaps that Mark was referring to while being blamed for not fixing the entire mess all at once.
But originally, the VCS was really about just letting 1,000 flowers bloom.
Mark Stewart is another economist we'll be meeting in the weeks ahead. He helped the government of Costa Rica develop the world's first forest carbon protocol in 1997, a groundbreaking success that we touched on in episode 56 called How Costa Rica Grew Both Its Forests and Its Economy. Like many of us in this space, he saw the VCS as a means to an end, a way of accelerating action until governments got their act together.
The most fond desire at the outset was that this thing would put itself out of business, you know, that the world would do better things.
But the world failed to do better things because our global media failed to understand, let alone communicate, the enormity of the climate challenge. As Columbia Journalism Review editor Kyle Pope pointed out in 2021, you can find that in the show notes or at bionic-planet.com. Look for episode 97. Now, back in episode 75, I warned that the more sensationalist tabloid elements of our mainstream media were about to recreate the mistakes that were made in covering climate science and apply them to climate solutions. One reporter who fulfilled that prophecy is Hannah Knut of Die Zeit. She, along with her sidekick, a guy named Tin Fisher, spent almost a year studying carbon markets, but still managed to get most of their premises and almost all of their conclusions wrong. In the weeks ahead, you'll get a chance to learn the truth and see how reality diverges from public discourse. For most of its existence, the VCS was a shoestring operation, willing to take on wicked challenges that no one else would touch. It succeeded in driving billions of dollars into improved land management and reducing deforestation around the world by reducing poverty. But it did so in ways that can't be quantified to the penny, and using tools and data sets that have, in some cases, now been eclipsed by newer technologies and policies that didn't exist 10 years ago. But for Hannah and Tin, this all constitutes a failure, because the VCS and its proponents weren't omniscient or omnipotent. Here is a snippet from a longer conversation we'll get into that illustrates that.
Okay, so you don't think the responsibility was there for you, for example, too, back in 2015 to say, all right, if we're like handing these credits over to companies, we should make sure how they're using it.
Now, this may seem like an innocuous question, and you could argue the only stupid question is the one not asked. But this question, as asked, illustrates the core cause of the disconnect between legitimate debate and public discourse, namely, different views of history and reality colliding in the public arena, instead of, say, a classroom where experts could correct the errors. This audio is from an on-the-record conversation we had with Hannah, Tin, and David Antonioli in late 2022, when David was CEO of Vera, which administers the VCS. So, on one side, here we had someone with decades of experience in the climate arena, who'd worked with dozens of leading experts to synthesize years of scientific conclusions drawn on decades of trial, error, and adjustment, tested and retested in the real world into methodologies for estimating deforestation risk. And now, 10 years on, the organization was in the midst of updating its methodologies to include new data sets and modeling approaches that didn't exist 10 years previously. And in the other corner, you have someone who parachuted into the space less than a year earlier, asking why they didn't implement these new approaches before the data sets and technologies they're built on existed, and while they were at it, why didn't they also develop a means of quantifying emissions in corporate supply chains and develop guidance for corporate claims back in 2015? This demonstrates a profound failure to even try to understand the challenges faced in estimating and then preventing forest loss, especially with limited resources. It's like screaming at a paramedic who just saved your life by cauterizing a wound or whatever they do to it, but failed to prevent you from falling in the first place and neglected to give you a pedicure as well. When I first started Bionic Planet in 2016, I went looking for money and found it almost always came with strings. There was lots of money for people who wanted to blow the lid off the carbon markets, and there were plenty of project proponents offering to fund positive coverage to counter the negative propaganda. I've argued for over a decade that we need to tell accurate stories, because the truth is on our side. Carbon projects are highly effective, especially when compared to viable alternatives instead of to imagined states of perfection. But nothing is 100%. I know that some proponents are putting a lot of money into an advertising campaign to tell positive stories. I'm fine with that, as long as it's labeled as advertising. But if you believe, as I do, that we need to tell full and accurate stories, then you can help me ramp up production in Season 9 by sponsoring individual episodes, specific verticals such as this one, or Green Cheetahs, or Red in Africa. For a schedule of sponsorship opportunities, reach out to me at steve@bionic-planet.com. That's steve@bionic-planet.com. I need to bring in at least $200,000 over the next year to even come close to generating the kind of high-quality content we need to make an impact. And with sponsorship, you'll be able to reach a global, mainstream, and climate-aware audience. If you're an individual, you can also help just by becoming a patron at patreon.com/bionicplanet. That's patreon.com/bionicplanet. Bionic Planet, all one word, no dots or dashes. Unlike in the email address where it is steve@bionic-planet.com. At Patreon, you can support the show for as little as $1 per episode and with a monthly cap. I've got plenty of interviews in the cans from my 2 months in Kenya, and I'll be rolling out at least one episode per week in April, May, and June, but only if I get the support I need. I'm wrapping up today's show with a little parable that, I hope, fleshes out the importance of telling the full story of the tribes of the climate realm in all of its glorious complexity. This realm has been taking shape at least since the World Climate Conference in 1979. If you've been here for a few years, you know how internally contentious it can be. Imagine for a moment two journalists being parachuted into a contested enclave of the realm, one where deforestation is rampant, and two natives step out of the woods. One of the natives is righteous, confident, and adorned in a tie-dyed shirt that says Rainbow Warrior on it. She invites the reporters on a glorious adventure where they'll get to scale tall buildings, ram ships in the high seas, and crash gliders into sporting events. Follow me, she says. We'll have loads of fun, and I'll tell you with absolute certainty how this all works, who the good guys are, and who the bad guys are. Listen to me, and I'll make you look good. The other native is quiet, humble, and a bit nerdy. She's got binoculars around her neck and a clinometer, which is a tool for measuring trees on her belt. She gushes over a rare banded caatinga she just saw sunning itself on a stump where a tree had been just a few days earlier. She invites the reporters to spend a month knee-deep in mud, swatting mosquitoes, measuring trees, and helping poor farmers shift from slash-and-burn agriculture to agroforestry. Deforestation is a wicked problem, she says. Its drivers are myriad, and there's no simple way to end it. But we've been working with thousands of foresters, economists, and engineers over the past 40 years of trial, error, and adjustment through multiple iterative rounds of expert review and public consultation to develop methodologies that, while not perfect, are better than anything anyone has tried before. And they're getting better all the time as policies change and science advances and data expands. Listen to me, she says, and, well, yeah, you might get a little confused for a bit, but if you apply yourself and question your premises and dig into the background literature, you'll eventually understand the nature of the challenge and the mosaic of interlocking solutions that we're bringing to bear on it. The first native has an easier story to tell, but the second one has a truer story to tell. The true story may be more complicated than the fake one, but it's also more captivating if we tell it right. I'm here to tell it right, and that's why I'm calling today's show The Mosaic, The Minefield, and A Manifesto. The mosaic reminds us that there is no single solution to the climate challenge. Instead, we have a mosaic of interlocking solutions that fit together like a giant clock. Carbon finance is just one part of it. And ironically, while it's one of the few parts that's worked, it's also the part that's been pushed most clumsily and inaccurately into public discourse. The minefield reminds us why this is happening, because this mosaic of solutions sits in an ideological minefield, and you never know if you're going to trigger an explosion. The trouble with ideologues is that when they lose a scientific argument, they'll do an end run to the general public, usually via gullible reporters. And that leads to the disconnect between the legitimate discussions taking place inside the climate realm and the silliness of public discourse, which also leads to the third component of the title of today's show, because this episode is also a manifesto of sorts, a sneak peek into the topics that I'll be covering in the coming months, and a promise to you. I promise to leverage my 20 years of experience in environmental finance to give you a truer, more nuanced, and complete understanding of the climate and biodiversity landscapes than you'll get anyplace else. And I'll be both fair and brutally honest, whether dealing with my own tribe or tribes I disagree with. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised to find that most of the inhabitants of the climate realm have the best interests of the planet at heart. And I promise not to vilify anyone who engages in honest discourse, even if I disagree, but I won't hold back with people who are cherry-picking or misrepresenting findings. Philosophical differences are inevitable in this space, and my primary overriding objective is to push the legitimate discussions into public discourse to ensure that a critical mass of people have the context they need to understand these exciting solutions. When I started Bionic Planet, I was a lone voice trying to tell the world that we need natural climate solutions. Now there are hundreds of voices out there, some of which are incredibly informative, but sometimes too technical, and others that are easy to understand, but not worth listening to. I promise to do my best to help you filter out the noise and make sense of the real issues. Over the next few weeks, I'll mostly be going back in time with a detailed look into the genesis of the VCS and the science behind the first generation of carbon projects. That's important because while the science and methodologies have changed, the processes for developing them have not. The best solutions still come through multiple iterative rounds of expert review and public consultation, while public discourse tends to be influenced by one-off papers and cherry-picked findings. I encourage you to visit my site, bionic-planet.com, and look at the show notes for episode 97, that's today's show. There you'll find some links to stuff I've written in the past. A lot of the site is still under construction, but feel free to poke around. You might find some interesting stuff there. Also, and most importantly, please consider becoming a patron of Bionic Planet at patreon.com/Bionic Planet. That's Bionic Planet, all one word, no dots or dashes. There you can support the show for as little as $1 per episode, although more is obviously better. You can also add in a monthly cap. So if I produce too many episodes in a month, you don't get an unpleasant surprise. Finally, if you're an ethical business looking to reach a global climate-aware audience, or if you're any entity looking to support my mission, then send me an email at steve@bionic-planet.com. That's steve@bionic-planet.com. I can also accept funding as a 501c3 through my fiscal sponsorship with Manga Bay. That address again is steve@bionic-planet.com. That's all for today. Until next time, I'm Steve Zwick in Chicago. Thanks for listening.